We're going to begin today in Washington, where the Supreme Court gave us two rulings, each a margin of 7-2, giving faith-based employers a lot of latitude on how they manage their employees and distribute health care. So for more, we're joined by WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins from Washington. Kimberly, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
So with the court pushing its term out into July, you and I are making a regular thing out of this at this point, Kimberly.
We are. It's the July SCOTUS Chronicles.
That's right. Listen, the first case we're going to talk about has to do with two California Catholic schools. So I just want to disclose that I led a Catholic organization here in Boston for a number of years, just kind of put that out there. Let's start with that ruling, Kimberly. It holds that certain employees of religious schools, religious hospitals, faith-based social service centers can't sue for employment discrimination. What is the thinking there?
Yeah, so essentially what the court considered is something called the ministerial exception to the First Amendment. What it means is the idea is that religious employers whose employees are dealing primarily with the teaching or other practice of religion can't sue for discrimination under federal discrimination laws, because the idea is that would bring the court into a dispute that would largely be about religion, and the First Amendment says that that's not what the government is supposed to do. So there is an exception here. The question in this case is whether that exception applies to people who aren't ministers, in this case teachers, whose jobs involved at least in part teaching religion. And the court found that it does, that these teachers cannot make claims of employment discrimination. Both of them had been dismissed for reasons that they said were discriminatory. The court said there's no action there because their job involved religion and they were employed by a religious employer. So it expanded that ministerial exception.
What was the counter argument from the two dissenting justices?
Yeah, so the dissenting justices, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote a dissent that was joined by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Sotomayor essentially said she feared that this will just allow religious employers to claim that any of their employers have some sort of religious role, because claiming so will allow them to escape liability, whether that employee had a real major part in teaching or being involved in religion at all. So she claimed that it just went too far.
So earlier today, Kimberly, we spoke with Andrew Beckwith, who's the president of the Massachusetts Family Institute. He said this is a big win for religious schools. Here he is.
This ruling gives religious schools in Massachusetts protection from what is now recognized as unconstitutional interference by the state in the hiring, firing, and management of employees. And that's a real win for people of faith in the Commonwealth.
Okay, so a couple of questions coming out of what Beckwith had to say there. The first is this just schools? It's not. Does this have a broader application beyond the two schools who were in the court case?
Well, we will have to see. What the Supreme Court usually likes to do is to hold things to the facts of the case. So in this case, it did involve schools. It was a fact-based determination which found that these particular teachers did, in fact, teach religion. That was part of their job. So what will happen when lower courts try to apply this rule is they will start for themselves, for the cases that come up, determining if these employers are in a similar spot as these teachers in having some role in teaching or advancing religion. And as some of those claims are challenged, it may make its way back to the Supreme Court to find out if other employees are still covered under this exception as well.
Okay, and so then the second question is, does this ruling mean in practical terms that religious employers can fire employees who they deem, or at least some set of employees who they deem, are not upholding the religious practices of the faith institution in question? So maybe potentially LGBTQ employees, divorced employees, et cetera.
Yeah, it's definitely a broadening of this rule, a broadening of this exception to bringing non-discrimination claims. That is without a doubt. And again, we'll have to see as these claims are played out, if the courts continue to say, yes, it applies to cases where there's religious objections for any number of reasons. And that is one of that's part of Justice Sotomayor's argument, is that it essentially creates this slippery slope where we can see this exception broadening far beyond what the court intended.
Are there potential implications then, Kimberly, for the finding last month by the court that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act applied workplace discrimination protection to LGBTQ workers? Any concern that these two things come in conflict?
These things come in conflict all the time, and that will be one of the things that the courts will have to balance, not just the Supreme Court, but the lower federal courts will have to balance in the future in trying to figure out just how far this exception applies in these cases. So that's an essential part of this debate.
So a lot more to watch there.
Yes.
Okay, so let's go to the second case, also decided 7-2, also involving employers and religion. This one allows some employers to decline to provide contraceptive coverage on religious or moral grounds. So first, does the court, these seem to be similar themed findings. Is that a thing the court does, group similarly themed cases together like this?
In this case, no. I mean, sometimes if two questions are very closely related, the court will hear them at the same time. But in this case, when you get to the end of the term, the court releases decisions as they're written. So it's largely coincidental that both of these cases came out today.
Okay, and what is the argument of the majority in this case on contraception coverage?
Yeah, so this is what I call just the latest episode in the long saga over the constitutional and procedural challenges to the contraception mandate in the ACA. The ACA provides, by and large, that employers must provide contraception to its employees at no cost to the employee. So first, some religious organizations, churches, objected to that, saying they don't want to provide this coverage. The Obama administration carved out an exception for them, that they don't have to do it. Then there was a challenge saying that the exception wasn't broad enough, that it still required these churches to do something to give folks another option to providing it. Another exception was carved out. So now the Trump administration put in place a rule that really broadened how far this exception went. It doesn't just apply to churches and religious organizations. It can apply to for-profit employers, publicly traded employers, and it's not just for religious objections to providing contraception. It's also an employer need only have a moral objection to providing contraception. So it really broadens this exception. The Supreme Court held that the administration had the procedural right to impose this rule. It wasn't a constitutional ruling on the judgment of this, but saying that basically they had the ability to do this under the law.
I'm going to bring another voice in just a minute, Kimberly, but before I do, what was the basis of the two justices who dissented on this opinion?
Yeah, so Justice Ginsburg wrote the dissent in this case that was joined by Justice Sotomayor. And Ginsburg basically argued that up to now, the court had taken a balanced approach about the right of religious employers and the need of women to be able to access contraception. She said this time the court really basically ceded to the demands of conservative interest in their zeal to secure religious rights. So she essentially says nothing has changed since the last time we considered this, but now the court is veering toward the right for a reason that isn't supported by the law.
Okay, Kimberly, if you'll stand by for a minute, I want to bring in another voice here. Joining us now is Rebecca Hart Holder. She is the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Massachusetts. Rebecca, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is your initial reaction to the court's ruling, Rebecca?
I'd like to say that I'm surprised, but I'm not. It's the decision that we were anticipating, and we really feel that the Supreme Court gave the green light to virtually any employer to deny insurance coverage of birth control to their employees with this decision. The personal beliefs of your boss really shouldn't have anything to do with personal decisions about your birth control. And I think it's really important to flag that this sets dangerous precedent for other healthcare decisions, such as covering LGBTQ-specific services or vaccinations.
So, Rebecca, that really is the question in the tension here, is how widely can this ruling by the court be applied? It sounds like you're concerned that it won't be a narrow group of employers, but you're concerned you'll see a wider group of employers claiming protection under this?
Yeah, we absolutely are. And I think that that is the Trump administration's end game. They've been very clear that they want to roll back the birth control benefit as part of their war against the Affordable Care Act. And certainly if you read Justice Kagan's concurring opinion, she makes clear that she thinks that there will be ongoing litigation about the right of the administration to really curtail insurance coverage for employees.
And what, in your estimation, Rebecca, does this ruling mean for women, especially women here in Massachusetts?
Well, the point about Massachusetts is very important. So when the Trump administration promulgated these regs in October of 2017, we sprang into action and helped get the access law passed. And that was signed into law in November of 2018. And that law mandates that all Massachusetts regulated insurance carriers offer contraceptive methods without copays or cost sharing. I mean, it even goes a little bit farther by guaranteeing that eligible people can receive an entire 12-month supply of birth control at once under Massachusetts law. So the state legislature really embraced its role as a trendsetter on healthcare and pushed back against the regs. So we're very pleased that here in Massachusetts, the majority of people are protected against this. That said, there is real risk for people across the nation who don't have these kind of protective laws.
Okay, that's Rebecca Hartholder. She's the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Massachusetts. Rebecca, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
So Kimberly Atkins, WBUR senior news correspondent, turning back to you, any reactions from what you just heard from Rebecca?
Yeah, it's important to note that states do have the ability to pass their own laws with respect to coverage in this way that imposes additional obligations on employers. It doesn't mean that those employers won't also bring constitutional challenges, but that's always a possibility to do. What advocates I've spoken to said they believe that this will impact as many as 126,000 women in their ability to get cost-free contraception. But in some states like Massachusetts, that would be different.
And, you know, there's a 2020 presidential election going on.
Yes.
These rulings today, do you think they will affect the landscape of that election or other rulings that we've gotten from SCOTUS recently?
Yeah, I think two things. One, these are both wins for the Trump administration that came down on their side. So it's something that the president can tout as a win. And the president has used the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary as a big reason to woo supporters to back him. It's what helped him win in 2016. And it's one reason why if he wins again, that would be a big reason why. So, yes, it's important to the election.
You and I were sort of alluding at the beginning of this conversation to the fact that it's unusual for the court to still be releasing opinions in July. I think it's been since 1996. There's a big one. The court has said that tomorrow is the final day. There are three key outstanding cases. I followed you on Twitter today and saw you note that doesn't necessarily mean that all three will come out tomorrow, but probably, right?
Right. We will probably see. Two of those cases involve President Trump and subpoenas that were issued, one by prosecutors in New York and the other by members of Congress seeking his financial records. It's a question of whether or not the White House can say, no, this goes beyond the authority of those prosecutors and those lawmakers to get those records. By and large, every indication is that those decisions will come out tomorrow, the last day of the year. Now, every now and again, with the Citizens United case being the last example, that decision was scheduled to come out. And because there had been a change on the court, what the court actually decided to do was to re-argue it the following year to let the new justice have a say in it. We don't have a circumstance like that right now, so I can't imagine a case where this decision won't come out, but you never know with this Supreme Court.
And in our last 30 seconds or so, Kimberly, how big a deal is the ruling that's expected tomorrow on the Trump administration subpoenas?
It's a really big deal. It doesn't just mean whether or not we may see these tax returns from President Trump, but it will delineate the breadth of executive authority, how much the White House can stop Congress or federal prosecutors from executing subpoenas and seeking information to a sitting president. So it's a pretty big deal.
All right. That is WBUR senior news correspondent in Washington, Kimberly Atkins. Thanks again, Kimberly. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.